Locke stared out the window a while longer. The mesh was up, as the Duke's wind was still blowing in strongly from the sea, and the insects weren't yet biting. Across the Via Camarazza, the arsenal district was mostly silent and motionless. With the iron sea city-states at relative peace, all the great sawyards and warehouses and wet docks had little business. In a time of need, they could build or service 24 ships at once. Now Locke could see only one skeletal hull rising within the yards. Beyond that, the sea broke white against the base of the South Needle, an elderglass-mortared stone breakwater nearly 3/4 of a mile in length. At its southernmost tip, a human-built watchtower stood out against the darkening sea. Beyond that, the white blurs of sails could be seen beneath the red tendrils of clouds in the sky. "Oh," he said, "I do believe something's happening." "Take a seat," said Jean. "You're supposed to get wobbly in just a bit." "Already happening. In fact, gods, I think I'm going to..." So it began. A great wave of nausea bubbled up in Locke's throat, and with it came everything he'd eaten for the past day. For a few long minutes he crouched on his knees, clutching a wooden bucket as devoutly as any man had ever prayed over an altar for intercession from the gods. "Jean!" he gasped out during a brief lull between spasms of retching. "Next time I conceive a plan like this, consider planting a hatchet in my skull." Hardly efficacious. Jean swapped a full bucket for an empty one and gave Locke a friendly pat on the back. "Dulling my nice sharp blades on a skull as thick as yours." One by one, Jean shuttered the windows. False light was just rising outside. "Ghastly as it is," he said, "we need the smell to make an impression when Andres shows up." Even once Locke's stomach was thoroughly emptied, the dry heaving continued. He shuddered and shook and moaned, clutching at his guts. Jean hauled him bodily over to a sleeping pallet, where he looked down in genuine worry. "You're pale and clammy," he muttered. "Not bad at all. Very realistic."
"Pretty, isn't it? Gods," whispered Locke. "How much longer?"
"Can't rightly say," said Jean. "They should be arriving down there right about now. Give them a few minutes to get impatient with waiting around for us and come storming up here." During those few minutes, Locke became intimately acquainted with the idea of a short eternity. Finally, there came the creak of footsteps on the stairs and a loud banging on the door.
"La Mora!" Angers Barsavi's voice. "Tannen, open up or I'll kick the damn door in."
"Thank the gods,"
croaked Locke as Jean rose to unbolt the door.
"We've been waiting out front of the last mistake. Are you coming or..." "Gods, what the hell happened in here?"
Angers threw one arm up over his face as he stepped into the apartment and the smell of sickness. Jean pointed to Locke, writhing on the bed, moaning, half wrapped in a thin blanket, despite the moist heat of the evening.
"He took ill just 30 minutes ago, maybe," said Jean, "losing his stomach all over the damn place. I don't know what's the matter."
"Gods, he's turning green!"
Andres took a few steps closer to Locke, staring in horrified sympathy. He was dressed for a fight, with a boiled leather cuirass, an unbuckled leather collar, and a pair of studded leather braces tied over his ham-like forearms. Several men had accompanied him up the stairs, but none of them seemed in any hurry to follow him into the rooms.
"I had capon for lunch," said Jean, "and he had fish rolls. That's the last thing either of us ate, and I'm fine."
"Yono's piss. Fish rolls. Fresher than he bargained for, I'd wager."
"Andres,"
Locke croaked, reaching out toward him with a shaking hand.
Don't leave me. I can still go. I can still fight."
"Gods, no." Andres shook his head emphatically. "You're in a bad way, La Mora. I think you'd best see a physicker. Have you summoned one, Tannen?"
"I haven't had a chance. I fetched out the buckets and I've been looking after him since it started."
"Well, keep it up. Both of you stay. No, don't get angry, Jean. He clearly can't be left on his own. Stay and tend him. Fetch a physicker when you can."
Andres gave Locke 2 brief pats on his exposed shoulder.
"We'll get the fucker tonight, Locke. No worries. We'll do him for good, and I'll send someone to look in on you when we're done. I'll square this with Papa. He'll understand."
"Please, please, Jean can help me stand. I can still..."
"End of discussion. You can't fucking stand up. You're sick as a fish dropped in a wine bottle."
Andres backed toward the door and gave Locke a brief sympathetic wave before he ducked out.
"If I get my hands on the bastard personally, I'll deck him once for you, Locke. Rest easy."
Then the door slammed, and Locke and Jean were alone once again. 4. Long minutes passed. Jean unshuttered the canal-side window and stared out into the glimmer of false light. He watched as Andres and his men broke loose from the crowds below, then hurried across a Via Camarazza cat bridge and into the arsenal district. Andres didn't look back even once, and soon enough he was swallowed up by shadows and distance.
"Long gone.
Can I help you out of..." Jean said, turning away from the window. Locke had already stumbled out of bed and was splashing water on the alchemical hearthstone, looking 10 years older and 20 pounds thinner. That was alarming. Locke didn't have 20 pounds to spare.
"Lovely. The least complicated, least important job of the night is done. Carry on, gentlemen bastards," said Locke.
His face was alight in the reflected glow of the simmering stone as he set a glazed jug of water atop it. 10 years older? More like 20.
"Now for the tea, gods bless it, and it had better be as good as the purple powder."
Jean grimaced and grabbed the 2 vomit buckets Locke had used, then moved back to the window. False light was dying down now. The hangman's wind was blowing up warm and strong, bringing a low ceiling of dark clouds with it, visible just past the 5 towers. The moons would be swallowed by those clouds tonight, at least for a few hours. Pinpricks of firelight were appearing across the city as though an unseen jeweler were setting his wares out on a field of black cloth.
"Jessalyn's little potion seems to have brought up every meal I've had in the past 5 years," said Locke. "Nothing left to spit up but my naked soul. Make sure it isn't floating around in one of those before you toss them, right?"
His hands shook as he crumbled the dry Somnay pine bark right into the jug of water. He didn't feel like messing about with proper tea brewing.
"I think I see it," Jean said. "Nasty, crooked little thing it is, too. You're better off with it floating out to sea."
Jean took a quick glance out the window to ensure that there were no canal boats drifting below in the path of a truly foul surprise, then simply flung the buckets one after the other. They hit the grey water 70-odd feet below with loud splashes, but Jean was certain nobody noticed or cared. Camorri were always throwing disgusting things into the Via Camarazza. Satisfied with his aim, Jean then slid the hidden closet open and pulled out their disguises, cheap traveller's cloaks and a pair of broad-brimmed Talvarar caps fashioned from some ignoble leather with the greasy texture of sausage casings. He flung one brownish-grey cloak over Locke's shoulders. Locke clutched at it gratefully and shivered.
"You've got that motherly concern in your eyes, Jean. I must look like hammered shit."
"Actually, you look like you were executed last week. I hate to ask, but are you sure you're going to be up for this?"
"Whatever I am, it has to be sufficient."
Locke wrapped one end of his cloak around his right hand and picked up the jug of half-boiled tea. He sipped and swallowed, bark and all, reasoning that the best place for the stuff would be his empty stomach.
"Ugh! It tastes like a kick in the gut feels. Have I pissed Jessalyn off recently, too?"
His expression was picturesque, as though the skin of his face were trying to peel itself back and leap off his bones. But he continued to choke the near tea down anyway. Jean steadied him by placing both hands on his shoulders, privately afraid that another bout of vomiting might be more than Locke could handle. After a few minutes, Locke set the empty jug down and sighed deeply.
"I can't wait to have words with the Grey King when this shit is all finished," Locke whispered. "There's a few things I want to ask him. Philosophical questions, like,
How does it feel to be dangled out a window by a rope tied around your balls, motherfucker?
Sounds more like physic than philosophy. But as you said, we have to wait for the falconer to leave first.
Jean's voice was steady and totally empty of emotion, the voice he always used when discussing a plan only loosely tethered to prudence and sanity.
Pity we can't just blindside the bastard from an alley.
Couldn't give him so much as a second to think, or we'd lose.
Anything less than 20 yards, mused Jean. One good throw with a wicked sister. Wouldn't take but half a second.
But you and I both know, Locke replied slowly, that we can't kill a bondsmage. We wouldn't live out the week. Carthane would make examples of us, plus Carlo, Galdo, and Bug as well. Not very clever at all, that way out. A drawn-out suicide.
Locke stared down at the fading glow of the hearthstone and rubbed his hands together. I wonder, Jean, I really wonder, is this what other people feel like when we're through with them? After we get the goods and pull the vanish and there's nothing they can do about it?
The light from the hearthstone sank several stages further before Jean answered. I thought we'd agreed long ago that they get what they deserve, Locke. Nothing more. This is a fantastically silly moment to start giving a shit.
Giving a shit?
Locke started, blinking as though he had just woken up.
No, don't get me wrong. It's just this sewn-up feeling. No way out is for other people, not for the gentleman bastards. I don't like being trapped.
At a sudden gesture from Locke, Jean pulled him to his feet. Jean wasn't sure if the tea was any more responsible than the cloak, but Locke was no longer shivering.
Too right, Locke continued, his voice gaining strength. Too right, I don't like it. Let's get this shit job over with. We can have a good ponder on the subject of our favourite grey ratfucker and his pet mage after I've danced to their little tune.
Jean grinned and cracked his knuckles, then ran a hand down the small of his back. The old familiar gesture, making sure that the wicked sisters were ready for a night out.
You sure, he said, that you're ready for the Vine Highway?
Ready as I can be, Jean. Hell, I weigh considerably less than I did before I drank that potion. Climbing down'll be the easiest thing I do all night.
5. The trellis ran up the full height of the broken tower on the westward face of the structure, overlooking a narrow alley. The lattice of wood was threaded with tough old vines and built around the windows on each floor. Though something of a bitch to climb, it was the perfect way to avoid the few dozen familiar faces that were sure to be in the last mistake on any given night. The gentleman bastards used the Vine Highway frequently. The alley side shutters banged open on the top floor of the broken tower. All the light inside Locke and Jean's suite of rooms had been extinguished. A large dark shape slid out into the mass of trellised vines, and was shortly followed by a smaller shape. Clinging with white-knuckled determination, Locke gently eased the shutters closed above him, then willed his queasy stomach to quit complaining for the duration of the climb. The hangman's wind, on its way out to the salty blackness of the iron sea, caught at his cap and cloak with invisible fingers that smelled of marshes and farmers' fields. Jean kept himself 2 or 3 feet under Locke, and they descended steadily, one foothold or handhold at a time. The windows on the 6th floor were shuttered and dark. Thin slivers of amber light could be seen around the shutters on the 5th floor. Both climbers slowed without the need for words and willed themselves to be as quiet as possible, to be patches of grey invisible against deeper darkness, nothing more. They continued down. The 5th floor shutters flew outward as Jean was abreast with them on their left. One hinged panel rebounded off his back, almost startling him out of his hold on the trellis. He curled his fingers tightly around wood and vine and looked to his right. Locke stepped on his head in surprise, but quickly pulled himself back up.
"I know there's no other way out, you miserable bitch!" hissed a man's voice.
There was a loud thump, and then a shudder ran up and down the trellis. Someone else had just gone out the window, and was scrabbling in the vines beside and just below them. A black-haired woman stuck her head out of the window, intent on yelling something in return, but when she caught sight of Jean through the cracks in her swinging shutter, she gasped. This in turn drew the attention of the man clinging just beneath her, a larger man even than Jean.
"What the hell is this shit?" he gasped. "What are you doing outside this window?"
"Amusing the gods, asshole." Jean kicked down and tried to nudge the newcomer further down the trellis, to no avail. "Kindly heave yourself down."
"What are you doing outside this window, huh? You like to sneak a peek? You can sneak a peek of my fist, cocksucker!"
Grunting with exertion, he began to climb back upward, grabbing at Jean's legs. Jean narrowly yanked himself out of the way, and the world reeled around him as he regained his balance. Black wall, black sky, wet black cobblestones 50 feet below. That was a bad fall, the kind that cracked men like eggs.
"All of you, get off my damned window now! Ferens, for Morganti's sake, leave them be and get down!"
the woman hollered.
"Shit!"
Locke muttered from a few feet above and to her left, his eloquence temporarily cowed into submission.
"Madam, you're complicating our night, so before we come in and complicate yours, kindly cork your bullshit bottle and close the god's damned window!"
She looked up aghast.
"Two of you? All of you, get down! Get down! Get down! Close your window! Close your window! Close your fucking window!" "I'll kill both you shit-suckers!"
huffed Ferenz.
"Drop you both off this fucking..."
There was a marrow-chillingly loud cracking noise, and the trellis shuddered beneath the hands of the three men clinging to it.
"Ah," said Locke. "Ah, that figures. Thanks ever so much, Ferenz."
Then there was a torrent of polysyllabic blasphemy from four mouths. Exactly who said what would never be clearly recalled. Two careful men were apparently the trellis limit. Under the weight of three careless flailers, it began to tear free of the stone wall with a series of creaks and pops. Ferenc surrendered to gravity and common sense and began sliding downward at prodigious speed, burning his hands as he went, all but peeling the trellis off the wall above him. It finally gave way when he was about 20 feet above the ground, flipping over and dashing him down into the darkened alley, where he was promptly covered in falling vines and wood. His descent had snapped off a section of trellis at least 30 feet long, starting just beneath Jean's dangling feet. Wasting no time, Locke shimmied to his right and dropped down onto the window ledge, shoving the screaming woman back with the tip of one boot. Jean scrambled upward, for the shutter still blocked his direct access to the window, and as the section of trellis under his hands began to pull out of the wall, he gracelessly swung himself over the shutter and in through the window, taking Locke with him. They wound up in a heap on the hardwood floor, tangled in cloaks.
"Get back out the fucking window now!"
the woman screamed, punctuating each word with a swift kick to Jean's back and ribs. Fortunately, she wasn't wearing shoes.
"That would be stupid," Locke said, from somewhere under his larger friend.
"Hey," Jean said. "Hey, hey!"
He caught the woman's foot and propelled her backward. She landed on her bed. It was the sort commonly called a dangler, a two-person hammock of strong but lightweight demi-silk, anchored to the ceiling at four points. She went sprawling across it, and both Locke and Jean suddenly noticed that she wasn't wearing anything but her small clothes. In the summer, a Komori woman's small clothes are small indeed.
"Out, you bastards! Out! Out! I..."
As Locke and Jean stumbled to their feet, the door on the wall opposite the window slammed open, and in stepped a broad-shouldered man with the slab-like muscles of a stevedore or a smith. Vengeful satisfaction gleamed in his eyes, and the smell of hard liquor rolled off him, sour and acute even from 10 paces away. Locke wasted half a second wondering how Ferenc had gotten back upstairs so quickly, and another half second realizing that the man in the doorway wasn't Ferenc. He giggled, briefly but uncontrollably. The night wind slammed the shutter against the open window behind him. The woman made a noise somewhere in the back of her throat, a noise not unlike a cat falling down a deep, dark well.
"You filthy bitch,"
the man said, his speech a thick, slow drawl.
"Filthy, filthy bitch! I just knew it! Knew you weren't alone!"
He spat, then shook his head at Locke and Jean.
"Two guys at once, too! Damn! Go figure! Guess it takes that many to replace me! Hope you boys had yourselves a fun time with another man's woman,"
he continued, drawing 9 inches of blackened steel stiletto from his left boot.
"'Cause now I'm gonna make you women!'
Jean spread his feet and moved his left hand under his cloak, ready to draw the sisters. With his right hand he nudged Locke a pace behind him.
"'Hold it!' Locke cried, waving both of his hands. "'I know what this looks like, but you've got the wrong idea, friend!'
He pointed at the petrified woman clinging to the hanging bed.
"'She came before we came!'
"'Gethys!'
hissed the woman.
"'Gethys, these men attack me! Get them! Save me!'
Gethys charged at Jean, growling. He held his knife out before him in the grip of an experienced fighter, but he was still drunk and he was still angry. Locke dodged out of the way as Jean caught Gethys by his wrist, stepped inside his reach, and sent him sprawling to the floor with a quick sweep of the legs. There was an unappetizing snapping noise, and the blade fell from Gethys' grip. Jean had retained a firm hold on his wrist, and then twisted as the man went down on his back. For a moment Gethys was too bewildered to cry out. Then the pain broke through to his dulled senses, and he roared. Jean hoisted him up off the ground with one quick yank by the front of his tunic, and then he shoved Gethys with all his might into the stone wall to the left of the window. The big man's head bounced off the hard surface, and he stumbled forward. The blurred arc of Jean's right fist met his jaw with a crack, abruptly cancelling his forward momentum. He flopped to the ground, boneless as a sack of dough.
"Yes!" cried the woman. "Now throw him out the window!"
"For the love of the gods, madam," snapped Locke, "can you please pick one man in your bedroom to cheer for and stick with him?"
"If he's found dead in the alley beneath your window," said Jean, "I'll come back and give you the same."
"And if you tell anyone that we came through here," added Locke, "you'll only wish he'd come back and given you the same."
"Gethys will remember," she screeched. "He'll certainly remember."
"A big man like him? Please." Jean made a show of arranging his cloak and redonning his hat. "He'll say it was 8 men and they all had clubs."
Locke and Jean hurried out the door through which Gethys had entered, which led to the landing of the fifth-floor steps on the north side of the tower. With the trellis damaged, there was nothing else for it but to proceed quickly down on foot and pray to the crooked warden. Locke drew the door closed behind them, leaving the bewildered woman sprawled on her hanging bed, with the unconscious Gethys curled up beside her window.
"The luck of the gods must certainly be with us," said Locke as they hurried down the creaking steps. "At least we didn't lose these stupid fucking hats."
A small dark shape hissed past them, wings fluttering, a sleek shadow visible as it swooped between them and the lights of the city.
"Well," Locke added, "for better or worse, from this point on, I suppose we're under the falconer's wing."
Interlude. Up the River. 1. Jean was away at the House of Glass Roses the afternoon that Locke found out he was going to be sent up the Angevine to live on a farm for several months. Hard rains were pounding Camor that idler's day, so Chains had taken Locke, Carlo, and Galdo down into the dining-room to teach them how to play Rich Man, Beggar Man, Soldier Man, Duke, a card game that revolved around attempting to cheat one's neighbour out of every last bent copper at his disposal. Naturally, the boys took to it quickly.
2, 3, and 5 of spires, said Carlo, plus the sigil of the 12.
Die screaming, half-wit, said Galdo. I've got a run of chalices and the sigil of the sun. Won't do you any good, quarter-wit. Hand over your coins.
Actually, said Father Chains, a sigil run beats a sigil stand, Carlo. Galdo would have you. Except...
"'Doesn't anyone care what I've got in my hand?' asked Locke.
"'Not particularly,' said Chains, "'since nothing in the game tops a full duke's hand.' He set his cards on the table and cracked his knuckles with great satisfaction.
"'That's cheating!' said Locke. "'That's 6 times in a row, and you've had the duke's hand for 2 of them!'
"'Of course I'm cheating,' said Chains. "'Game's no fun unless you cheat. "'When you figure out how I'm cheating, then I'll know you're starting to improve.'
"'You shouldn't have told us that,' said Carlo. "'We'll practice all week,' said Galdo. "'We'll be robbing you blind,' said Locke, "'by the next Idler's Day.'
"'I don't think so,' said Chains, chuckling, "'since I'm sending you off on a 3-month apprenticeship on Penance Day.'
"'You're what?'
"'Remember last year when I sent Carlo off to Lashane "'to pretend to be an initiate in the Order of Gandalo, "'and Galdo went to Ashmere to slip into the Order of Sendovani? "'Well, your turn's come.' You'll be going up the river to be a farmer for a few months.
A farmer?
Yes, you might have heard of them.
Chains gathered the cards from around the table and shuffled them.
They're where our food comes from.
Yes, but I don't know anything about farming.
Of course not. You didn't know how to cook, serve, dress like a gentleman, or speak Vadran when I bought you either. So now you're going to learn something else new.
Where?
Up the Angevine, 7 or 8 miles. Little place called Villa Senziano. It's tenant farmers, mostly beholden to the Duke or some of the minor swells from the Alcigrante. I'll dress as a priest of Dama Elisa, and you'll be my initiate, being sent off to work the earth as part of your service to the goddess. It's what they do.
"'But I don't know anything about the Order of Dama Elisa.'
"'You won't need to. "'The man you'll be staying with understands that you're one of my little bastards. "'The story's just for everyone else.'
"'What,' said Carlo, "'are we going to do in the meantime?'
"'You'll mind the temple. "'I'll only be gone 2 days. "'The eyeless priest can be sick and locked away in his chambers.' "'Don't sit the steps while I'm away. "'People always get sympathetic if I'm out of sight for a bit, "'especially if I cough and hack when I return. "'You two and Jean can amuse yourselves as you see fit, "'so long as you don't make a bloody mess of the place.'
"'By the time I get back,' said Locke, "'I'll be the worst card player in the temple.'
"'Yes, best wishes for a safe journey, Locke,' said Carlo.
"'Savour the country air,' said Galdo. "'Stay as long as you like.'
2. The 5 towers loomed over Camor like the upstretched hand of a god. 5 irregular, soaring, elder-glass cylinders, dotted with turrets and spires and walkways, and much curious evidence that the creatures that had designed them did not quite share the aesthetic sense of the humans who'd appropriated them. Easternmost was Dawncatcher, 400 feet high, its natural colour a shimmery silver-red, like the reflection of a sunset sky in a still body of water. Behind it was Blackspear, slightly taller, made of an obsidian glass that shone with broken rainbows like a pool of oil. At the far side, as one might reckon by looking across the 5 with Dawncatcher in the middle of one's vision, was Westwatch, which shone with the soft violet of a tourmaline, shot through with veins of snow-white pearl. Beside it was stately amber-glass, with its elaborate flutings from which the wind would pull eerie melodies. In the middle, tallest and grandest of all, was Raven's Reach, the palace of Duke Nicovante, which gleamed like molten silver, and was crowned with the famous Sky Garden, whose lowest-hanging vine trailed in the air some 600 feet above the ground. A network of glassine cables, miles and miles of spun elderglass cords had been found in the tunnels beneath Camor centuries before, threaded the roofs and turret tops of the 5 towers, Hanging baskets passed back and forth on these cables, drawn along by servants at huge, clacking capstans. These baskets carried both passengers and cargo. Although many of the residents of Lower Camor proclaimed them mad, the nobles of the five families regarded the lurching, bobbing passage across the yawning empty spaces as a test of honor and courage. Here and there, large cargo cages were being drawn up or lowered from jutting platforms on several of the towers. They reminded Locke, who stared up at all this with eyes that were not yet sated with such wonders, of the spider cages at the Palace of Patience. He and Chains sat in a two-wheeled cart with a little walled space behind the seat, where Chains had stashed several parcels of goods under an old canvas tarp. Chains wore the loose brown robes with green and silver trim that marked a priest of Dama Eliza, mother of rains and reaping. Locke wore a plain tunic and breeches, without shoes. Chains had their two horses, ungentled, for Chains misliked using the white-eyed creatures outside city walls, trotting at a gentle pace up the winding cobbles of the Street of Seven Wheels, the heart of the Mill Falls district. In truth, there were more than seven wheels spinning in the white froth of the Angevine. There were more in sight than Locke could count. The five towers had been built on a plateau some 60-odd feet above the lower city. The Alchigrante Islands sloped up toward the base of this plateau. The Angevine came into Camor at that height, just to the east of the five, and fell down a crashing six-story waterfall nearly 200 yards across. Wheels turned at the top of these falls, within a long glass and stone bridge topped with wooden mill houses. Wheels turned beneath the falls as well, jutting out into the river on both sides, making use of the rushing white flow to work everything from grinding stones to the bellows that blew air across the fires beneath brewers' vats. It was a district choked with business folk and labourers alike, with escorted nobles in gilded carriages rolling here and there to inspect their holdings or place orders. They turned east at the tip of the Mill Falls and crossed a wide, low bridge into the Chenza Gate district, the means by which most northbound land traffic left the city. There was a great mess, barely controlled by a small army of yellow jackets. Caravans of wagons were rolling into the city, their drivers at the mercy of the Duke's tax and customs agents, men and women marked by their tall, black, brimless caps, and commonly referred to, when out of earshot, as vexationers. Petty merchants were pitching everything from warm beer to cooked carrots. Beggars were pleading countless improbable reasons for impoverishment and claiming lingering wounds from wars that had obviously ended long before they were born. Yellow jackets were driving the most persistent or malodorous off with their black lacquered sticks. It was not yet the 10th hour of the morning. "You should see this place around noon," said Chains, "especially during harvest time, and when it rains. Gods!" Chains' clerical vestments and a silver solon passed over in a handshake got them out of the city with little more than a "Good day, Your Holiness." The Chenza Gate was 15 yards wide, with huge ironwood doors almost as tall. The guardhouses on the wall were occupied, barracks-like, not just by the city watch, but by the blackjackets, Camor's regular soldiers. They could be seen pacing here and there atop the wall, which was a good 20 feet thick. North of Camor proper was neighbourhood after neighbourhood of lightly built stone and wooden buildings, arranged in courts and squares more airy than those found on the islands of the city itself. Along the riverbank there were the beginnings of a marsh. To the north and east were terraced hills, crisscrossed by the white lines of boundary stones set out to mark the property of the families that farmed them. The air took on divergent qualities depending on which way the chance breezes blew. It would smell of sea salt and wood smoke one minute, of manure and olive groves the next. "Here beyond the walls," said Chains, "is what many folks living outside the great cities would think of as cities. These little scatterings of wood and stone that probably don't look like much to someone like you. Just as you haven't really seen the country, most of them haven't truly seen the city. So keep your eyes open and your mouth shut, and be mindful of differences until you've had a few days to acclimate yourself."
What's the point of this trick, Chains, really?
You might one day have to pretend to be a person of very lowly station, Locke. If you learn something about being a farmer, you'll probably learn something about being a teamster, a barge poleman, a village smith, a horse physicker, and maybe even a country bandit.
The road north from Camor was an old Therinthrone road, a raised stone expanse with shallow ditches at the sides. It was covered with a gravel of pebbles and iron filings, waste from the forges of the coal smoke district. Here and there the rains had fused or rusted the gravel into a reddish cement. The wheels clattered as they slid over these hard patches.
"A lot of black jackets," Chains said slowly, "come from the farms and villages north of Camor. It's what the Dukes of Camor do when they need more men, and they can afford to wait a bit without raising a general levy of the lowborn. It's good wages, and there's the promise of land for those that stay in service a full 25 years, assuming they don't get killed, of course. They come from the north, and mostly they go back to the north."
"Is that why the black jackets and the yellow jackets don't like each other?"
"Eh." Chain's eyes twinkled. "Good guess. There's some truth to it. Most of the yellow jackets are city boys that want to stay city boys. But on top of that, soldiers can be some of the cattiest, most clannish damn folk you'll ever find outside of a high-born lady's wardrobe. They'll fight over anything. They'll brawl over the colours of their hats and the shapes of their shoes. I know, believe me."
"You pretended to be one once?"
13 gods, no. I was one."
"A black jacket?"
"Yes."
Chains sighed and settled back against the hard wooden seat of the horse cart.
30 years passed now. More than 30. I was a pikeman for the old Duke Nicovante. Most of us from the village my age went. It was a bad time for wars. Duke needed fodder. We needed food and coin."
"Which village?"
Chains favoured him with a crooked smile.
"Villa Senziano. Gods, it was a whole pile of us that went."
The horses and the cart rattled down the road for a few long moments before Chains continued.
"There were 3 of us that came back, or at least got out of it."
"Only 3?
"That I know of."
Chains scratched at his beard.
"One of them is the man I'm going to be leaving you with, Vandross. A good fellow, not book-smart, but very wise in the everyday sense. He did his 25 years, and the Duke gave him a spot of land as a tenancy."
"Tenancy?"
"Most common folk outside the city don't own their own land any more than city renters own their buildings. An old soldier with a tenancy gets a nice spot of land to farm until he dies. It's a sort of allowance from the Duke."
Chains chuckled.
"Given in exchange for one's youth and health."
"You didn't do the 25, I'm guessing."
"No."
Chains fiddled with his beard a bit more, an old nervous gesture.
"Damn, I wish I could have a smoke. It's a very frowned-on thing in the Order of the Dharma, mind you. No, I took sick after a battle. Something more than just the usual shits and sore feet. A wasting fever. I couldn't march, and I was like to die, so they left me behind. Myself and many others. In the care of some itinerant priests of Perelandro."
"But you didn't die."
"Clever lad," said Chains, "to deduce that from such slender evidence after living with me for just 3 years."
"And what happened?"
"A great many things," said Chains. "And you know how it ends. I wound up in this cart, riding north and entertaining you."
"Well, what happened to the 3rd man from your village?"
"Him? Well," said Chains, "he always had his head on right. He made Banneret sergeant not long after I got laid up with the fever. At the Battle of Nesek, he helped young Nicovante hold the line together when old Nicovante took an arrow right between his eyes. He lived, got elevated, and served Nicovante in the next few wars that came their way.
And where is he?
At this very moment? How should I know? But, said Chains, later this afternoon he'll be giving Jean Tannen his usual afternoon weapons lesson at the House of Glass Roses.
Oh, said Locke.
Funny old world, said Chains. Three farmers became three soldiers. Three soldiers became one farmer, one baron, and one thieving priest.
And now I'm to become a farmer for a while.
Yes, useful training indeed, but not just that.
What else?
Another test, my boy. Just another test.
Which is?
All these years you've had me looking over you. You've had Carlo and Galdo and Jean and Sabatha from time to time. You've gotten used to the temple as a home. But time's a river, Locke, and we've always drifted farther down it than we think.
He smiled down at Locke with real affection.
I can't stand watch on you forever, boy. Now we need to see what you can do when you're off in a strange new place all on your own.
Chapter 8. The Funeral Cask. 1. It began like this, with the slow, steady beat of mourning drums, and the slow cadence of marchers moving north from the floating grave, red torches smouldering in their hands, a double line of blood-red light stretched out beneath the low, dark clouds. At its heart was Vencarlo Barsavi, cupper of Camor, with a son at either hand. Before him was a covered casket draped in black silk and cloth of gold, carried at either side by 6 pallbearers, one for each of the 12 Therin gods, dressed in black cloaks and black masks. At Barsavi's back was a huge wooden cask on a cart pulled by another 6 men, with a black-shrouded priestess of the Nameless 13th close behind. The drums echoed against stone walls, against stone streets and bridges and canals. The torches cast reflections of fire in every window and shred of elderglass they passed. Folk looked on in apprehension, if they looked on at all. Some bolted their doors and drew shutters over their windows as the funeral procession passed. This is how things are done in Camor, for the rich and the powerful. The slow, mournful march to the Hill of Whispers, the interment, the ceremony, and then the wild, tearful celebration afterward. A toast on behalf of the departed, a bittersweet revel for those not yet taken for judgment by Azaguia, Lady of the Long Silence. The funeral cask is what fuels this tradition. The lines of marchers left the wooden waste just after the 10th hour of the evening, and marched into the cauldron, where no urchin or drunkard dared to get in their way, where gangs of cutthroats and gaze addicts stood in silent attention as their master and his court walked past. Through coal smoke they marched, and then north into the quiet, as silvery mist rose warm and clinging from the canals around them. Not a single yellow jacket crossed their path. Not one constable even caught sight of the procession. Arrangements had been made to keep them busy elsewhere that night. The east belonged to Barsavi and his long lines of torches, and the farther north he went, the more honest families bolted their doors and doused their lights, and prayed that the business of the marchers lay far away from them. Had there been many staring eyes, they might have noticed that the procession had already failed to turn toward the Hill of Whispers, that it had instead gone north and snaked toward the western tip of the Rust Water district, where the great abandoned structure called the Echo Hole loomed in the darkness and the fog. A curious observer might have wondered at the sheer size of the procession, more than 100 men and women, and at their accoutrements. Only the pallbearers were dressed for a funeral. The torchbearers were dressed for war, in armor of boiled leather with blackened studs, in collars and helmets and braces and gloves, with knives and clubs and axes and bucklers at their belts. They were the cream of Barsavi's gangs, the hardest of the right people, cold-eyed men and women with murders to their names. They were from all of his districts and all of his gangs, the Red Hands and the Rum Hounds, the Grey Faces and the Arsenal Boys, the Canal Jumpers and the Black Twists, the Catchfire Barons and a dozen others. The most interesting thing about the procession, however, was something no casual observer could know. The fact was, Nazca Barsavi's body still lay in her old chambers in the floating grave, sealed away under silk sheets, alchemically impregnated to keep the rot of death from setting in too quickly. Loch Lamora and a dozen other priests of the Nameless 13th, the Crooked Warden, had said prayers for her the previous night, and placed her within a circle of sacred candles, there to lie until her father finished his business this evening, which had nothing to do with the Hill of Whispers. The coffin that was draped in funeral silks was empty. 2.
"I am the Grey King," said Loch Lamora. "I am the Grey King, God's damn his eyes, I am the Grey King."
"A little lower," said Jean Tannen, struggling with one of the grey cuffs of Locke's coat, "and a little scratchier. Give it a hint of Tal Verar. You said he had an accent."
"I am the Grey King," said Locke, "and I'll be smiling out the other side of my head when the gentleman bastards are through with me."
"Oh, that's good," said Carlo,
who was streaking Locke's hair with a foul-scented alchemical paste that was steadily turning it charcoal grey.
"I like that one. Just different enough to be noticed."
Locke stood stock still as a tailor's mannequin, surrounded by Carlo, Galdo, and Jean, who worked on him with clothes cosmetics and threaded needles. Bug leaned up against one wall of their little enclosure, keeping his eyes and ears alert for interlopers. The gentleman bastards were hidden away in an abandoned storefront in the fog-choked Rustwater district, just a few blocks north of the Echo Hole. Rustwater was a dead island, ill-favoured and barely inhabited. A city that had thrown off its old prejudices about the structures of the Eldrin still held Rustwater in an unequivocal dread. It was said that the black shapes that moved in the Rustwater lagoon were nothing as pleasant as mere man-eating sharks, but something worse, something older. Whatever the truth of those rumours, it was a conveniently deserted place for Barsavi and the Grey King to play out their strange affair. Locke privately suspected that he'd been taken somewhere in this neighbourhood on the night the Grey King had first interrupted his life. They were working every trick of their masquerade art to fashion Locke into the Grey King. Already his hair was grey, his clothes were grey, he was dressed in heavy padded boots that added 2 inches to his height, and he had a drooping grey moustache firmly affixed above his lips.
"It looks good," said Bug, an approving note in his voice.
"Damn showy, but Bug's right," said Jean. "Now that I've got this stupid coat cinched in to your proper size, you do look rather striking."
"Pity this isn't one of our games," said Galdo. "I'd be enjoying myself. Lean forward for some wrinkles, Locke."
Working very carefully, Galdo painted Locke's face with a warm, waxy substance that pinched his skin as it went on. In seconds it dried and tightened, and in just a few moments Locke had a complete network of crow's feet, laugh lines, and forehead wrinkles. He looked to be in his mid-40s at the very least. The disguise would have done very well in the bright light of day. At night it would be impenetrable.
"Virtuoso," said Jean. "Relatively speaking, for such short notice and the conditions we have in which to put it all together."
Locke flipped his hood up and pulled on his grey leather gloves.
"I am the Grey King," he said, his voice low, mimicking the odd accent of the real Grey King.
"I bloody well believe it," said Bug.
"Well, let's get on with everything then." Locke moved his jaw up and down, feeling the false wrinkle skin stretch back and forth as he did so. "Galdo, hand me my stilettos, would you? I think I'll want one in my boot and one in my sleeve."
"Lamora,"
came a cold whisper, the falconer's voice. Locke tensed, then realized that the noise hadn't come from the air.
"What is it?" asked Jean.
"It's the falconer," said Locke. He's doing that damned thing."
"Barsavi will soon be at hand. You and your friends must be in place ere long."
"We have an impatient bondsmage," said Locke. "Quickly now. Bug, you know the game, and you know where to put yourself?"
"I've got it down cold," said Bug, grinning. "Don't even have a temple roof to jump off this time, so don't worry about anything."
"Jean, you're comfortable with your place?"
"Not really, but there's none better."
Jean cracked his knuckles. "I'll be in sight of Bug down beneath the floor. If the whole thing goes to shit, you just remember to throw yourself down the damn waterfall. I'll cover your back, the sharp and bloody way." "Carlo, Galdo." Locke whirled to face the twins, who had hurriedly packed away all the tools and substances used to dress Locke up for the evening. "Are we good to move at the temple?"
"It'll be smoother than a gilded lily's backside if we do," said Galdo. "A sweet fat fortune wrapped up in sacks, two carts with horses, provisions for a nice long trip on the road. And there's men at the Viscount's gate who'll slip us out so fast, it'll be like we'd never even set foot in Camor in the first place," added Carlo.
"Good. Well, shit." Locke rubbed his gloved hands together. "I guess that's that. I'm all out of rhetorical flourishes, so let's just go get the bastards and pray for a straight deal." Bug stepped forward and cleared his throat.
"I'm only doing this," he said, "because I really love hiding in haunted Eldrin buildings on dark and creepy nights."
"You're a liar," said Jean slowly. "I'm only doing this because I've always wanted to see Bug get eaten by an Eldrin ghost."
"Liar," said Carlo. "I'm only doing this because I fucking love hauling half a ton of bloody coins up out of a vault and packing them away on a cart." "Liar," Galdo chuckled. "I'm only doing this because while you're all busy elsewhere, I'm going to pawn all the furniture in the burrow at No Hope Hawser's."
"You're all liars," said Locke, as their eyes turned expectantly to him. "We're only doing this because nobody else in Camor is good enough to pull this off, and nobody else is dumb enough to get stuck doing it in the first place."
"Bastard!" they shouted in unison, forgetting their surroundings for a bare moment.
"I can hear you shouting," came the ghostly voice of the falconer. "Have you all gone completely mad?"
Locke sighed. "Uncle doesn't like us keeping him up all night with our carrying on," he said. "Let's get to it, and by the grace of the crooked warden, we'll all see each other back at the temple when this mess is over."
3. The echo hole is a cube of grey stone mortared with a dull sort of elder glass. It never gleams at false light. In fact, it never returns the reflection of any light passed before it. It is perhaps 100 feet on a side, with one dignified entrance, a man-sized door about 20 feet above the street at the top of a wide staircase. A single aqueduct cuts from the upper Angevine past the millfalls, south at an angle and into Rustwater, where it spills its water into the heart of the echo hole. Like the stone cube itself, this aqueduct is thought to be touched by some ancient ill, and no use has ever been made of it. A small waterfall plunges through a hole in the floor, down into the catacombs beneath the echo hole, where dark water can be heard rushing. Some of these passages empty into the canal on the southwestern side of Rustwater. Some empty into no place known to living men. Locke Lamora stood in darkness at the center of the echo hole, listening to the rush of water down the break in the floor, staring fixedly at the patch of greyness that marked the door to the street. His only consolation was that Jean and Bug, crouched unseen in the wet darkness beneath the floor, would probably be even more apprehensive, at least until the proceedings started.
"Near," came the voice of the falconer. "Very near. Stand ready."
Locke heard the cupper's procession before he saw it. The sound of funeral drums came through the open door to the street, muffled and nearly drowned out by the falling water. Steadily it grew louder. A red glow seemed to kindle beyond the door, and by that light Locke saw that the grey mist had thickened. Torches flickered softly, as though glimpsed from underwater. The red aura rose. The barest outline of the room around him became visible, etched in faint carmine. The beating of the drum ceased, and once again Locke was alone with the sound of the waterfall. He threw back his head, placed one hand behind his back, and stared at the door, his blood pounding in his ears. Two small red fires appeared in the doorway like the eyes of a dragon from one of Jean's stories. Black shadows moved behind them, and as Locke's eyes adjusted to the influx of scarlet light, he saw the faces of men, tall men, cloaked and armoured. He could see enough of their features and posture to see that they were almost surprised to spot him. They hesitated, then continued forward, one moving to his left and the other to his right. For his part, he did nothing, moving not a muscle. Two more torches followed, and then two more. Barsavi was sending his men up the stairs in pairs. Soon a loose semicircle of men faced Locke, and their torches cast the interior of the echo hole into red-shaded relief. There were carvings on the walls, strange old symbols in the tongue of the Eldrin, which men had never deciphered. A dozen men, two dozen. The crowd of armoured shapes grew, and Locke saw faces that he recognised. Throat-slitters, leg-breakers, maulers, assassins. A hard lot. Exactly what Barsavi had promised him, when they'd stood looking down at the body of Nazca together. Moments passed. Still Locke said nothing. Still men and women filed in. The Barangia sisters, even in a dimmer light, Locke would have recognized their swagger. They stood at front and center of the gathering crowd, saying nothing, arms folded and eyes gleaming in the torchlight. By some unspoken command, none of Barsavi's people moved behind Locke. He continued to stand alone, as the great press of right people continued spreading before him. At last, the crowd of cutthroats began to part. Locke could hear the echoes of their breathing and murmuring and the creaking of their leathers bouncing from wall to wall, mingling with the sound of falling water. Some of those on the edges of the crowd extinguished their torches with wet leather pouches. Gradually the smell of smoke seeped into the air, and gradually the light sank, until perhaps one in five of the Kappa's folk were still holding lit fires. There was more than enough light to see Kappa Barsavi as he turned the corner and stepped through the door. His grey hair was pulled back in oiled rows. His three beards were freshly brushed. He wore his coat of sharkskin leather and a black cloak of velvet lined with cloth of gold, thrown back from one shoulder. Andres was on his right and Panchero on his left as the Kappa strode forward, and in the reflected fires of their eyes Locke saw nothing but death.
"Nothing is as it seems," came the voice of the falconer. "Stand resolute."
At the front of the crowd Barsavi halted, and for a long moment he stared at the apparition before him, at the cool orange eyes with a shadowed hood, at Locke's cloak and mantle and coat and gloves of grey.
"King," he finally said.
"Kappa,"
Locke replied, willing himself to feel the hauteur, conjuring it forth from nothing, the sort of man who would stand in front of 100 killers with a smile on his face, the sort of man who would summon Vencarlo Barsavi with a trail of corpses, the last of them his only daughter. That was the man Locke needed to be, not Nazca's friend, but her murderer, not the Kappa's mischievous subject, but his equal, his superior. Locke grinned, wolfishly, then swept his cloak back from his left shoulder. With his left hand he beckoned the Kappa, a taunting gesture, like a bully in an alley, daring his opponent to step forward and take the first swing.
"Oblige him,"
said the Kappa, and a dozen men and women raised crossbows. "Crooked warden," thought Locke, "give me strength." He ground his teeth in expectation. He could hear his jaw muscles creaking. The snap hiss of release echoed throughout the hall. A dozen taut strings twanged. The bolts were too fast to follow, dark afterimages that blurred the air, and then a dozen narrow black shapes rebounded off nothing right before his face and fell clattering to the floor, scattered in an arc like dead birds at his feet. Locke laughed, a high and genuine sound of pleasure. For one brief moment he would have kissed the falconer if the bondsmage had stood before him.
"Please," he said, "I thought you'd listen to the stories." "Just establishing your bona fides," said Kappa Barsavi. "Your Majesty."
The last word was sneered. Locke had at least expected a certain wariness following the blunting of the crossbow attack, but Barsavi stepped forward without apparent fear.
"I'm pleased that you've answered my summons," Locke replied. "The blood of my daughter is the only thing that summoned me," said Barsavi.
"Dwell on it if you must," said Locke, praying silently as he extemporized.
"Nazca, gods, please forgive me."
"Were you any gentler when you took this city for yourself 22 years ago? Is that what you think you're doing?"
Barsavi stopped and stared at him. They were about 40 feet apart.
"Taking my city from me?" "I summoned you to discuss the matter of Camor," said Locke, "to settle it to our mutual satisfaction."
The falconer hadn't interrupted him yet. He presumed he was doing well.
"The satisfaction," said Barsavi, "will not be mutual."
He raised his left hand, and one man stepped from the crowd. Locke peered at this man carefully. He seemed to be an older fellow, slight and balding, and he wasn't wearing armor. Very curious. He also appeared to be shivering.
"Do as we discussed, Aemon," said the Kappa. "I'll hold true to my bargain, truer than any I've ever made."
The unarmored man began to walk forward, slowly, hesitantly, staring at Locke with obvious fear. But still he kept coming, straight toward Locke, while 100 armed men and women waited behind him, doing nothing.
"I pray," said Locke, with a bantering tone, "that man isn't contemplating what I suspect." "We'll all see what his business is soon enough," said the Kappa. "I cannot be cut or pierced," said Locke, "and this man will die at my touch." "So it's been said," replied the Kappa.
Aemon continued to move forward. He was 30 feet from Locke, then 20.
"Aemon," said Locke, "you are being ill-used. Stop now."
"Gods," he thought, "don't do what I think you're going to do. Don't make the falconer kill you." Aemon continued to shamble forward. His jowls were quivering, and he was breathing in short, sharp gasps. His hands were out before him, shaking like a man about to reach into a fire. "Crooked warden," Locke thought. "Please let him be scared. Please let him stop. Falconer, falconer, please put a fright into him. Do anything else but kill him." A river of sweat ran down his spine. He bent his head slightly and fixed Aemon with a stare. 10 feet now lay between them.
"Aemon," he said,
striving for a casual tone and not entirely succeeding,
"you have been warned. You are in mortal peril."
"Oh, yeah," said the man, his voice quavering. "Yeah, that I know."
And then he closed the distance between them, and he reached out for Locke's right arm with both of his hands. Fuck, thought Locke, and although he knew deep down that it would be the falconer killing the man and not himself, he flinched back from Aemon's touch. Aemon's eyes lit up. He gasped, and then, to Locke's horror, he leapt forward and grabbed Locke's arm with both of his hands, like a scavenger bird clutching at a long-delayed meal.
"Ah!"
he cried, and for one brief second Locke thought something terrible was happening to him. But no, Imon still lived, and he had a very firm grip. "Double fuck," Locke mumbled, bringing up his left fist to clout the poor fellow, but he was off balance, and Imon had him at a disadvantage. The slender man gave Locke a shove backward, screaming once again, "Ah!" A cry of absolute triumph. Locke puzzled over it as he fell flat on his ass. And then there were booted feet slapping the stones behind Imon, and dark shapes rushing around him to grab at Locke. In the dancing light cast by 24 moving torches, Locke found himself hauled back up to his feet, pinned by strong hands that clutched at his arms and his shoulders and his neck. Kappa Barsavi pushed through his eager crowd of men and women, forced Imon more gently to the side, and stood face to face with Locke, his fat, ruddy features alight with anticipation.
"Well, Your Majesty," he said, "I'll bet you're one confused son of a bitch right about now."
And then Barsavi's people were laughing, cheering. And then the copper's ham-hock fist planted itself in Locke's stomach, and the air rushed out of his lungs, and black pain exploded in his chest. And then he knew just how deeply in the shit he truly was. 4.
"Yes, I'll bet you're pretty godsdamned curious at this point," said Barsavi, strutting back and forth in front of Locke, who remained pinioned by 6 men, any one of them half again his size. "And so am I. Let's throw that hood back, boys."
Rough hands yanked at Locke's hood and mantle, and the Kappa stared coldly at him, running one hand up and down his beards.
"Grey, grey, grey. You look like you belong on a stage," he laughed. "And such a skinny fellow, too. What a weak little man we've caught ourselves tonight. The Grey King, sovereign of fog and shadows and precious little else."
The Kappa backhanded him, grinning. The stinging pain had just registered when he did it again from the other direction. Locke's head lolled. He was grabbed from behind by his hair and made to look the Kappa right in the face. Locke's thoughts whirled. Had the Kappa's men somehow located the falconer? Had they distracted him? Was the Kappa mad enough to actually kill a bondsmage if he had the chance?
"Oh, we know you can't be cut," continued Barsavi. "And we know you can't be pierced, more's the pity. But bruised? It's a curious thing about the spells of a bondsmage. They're so damn specific, aren't they?"
And then he punched Locke in the stomach again, to a murmur of widespread amusement. Locke's knees buckled beneath him, and his attendants hoisted him again, holding him upright as bolts of pain radiated from his abdomen.
"One of your men," said Barsavi, "strolled into my floating grave this very morning."
A little chill crept down Locke's spine.
"Seems I'm not the only one you pissed off when you sent my Nazca back to me the way you did," said Barsavi, leering. "Seems that some of your men didn't sign on with your merry little crew for that sort of God's damn desecration. So your man and I, we had ourselves a talk, and we fixed a price, and then he told me all sorts of fascinating things about that spell of yours, and that story about you being able to kill men with a touch. Oh, he told me it was bullshit."
"Sewn up," said a little voice at the back of Locke's head that most certainly was not the falconer. "Sewn up, sewn up." Of course the falconer hadn't been distracted or taken by any of Barsavi's men. Neat as a god's damned hanging.
"But I was only willing to trust the fellow so far," Barsavi said. "So I made a deal with Imon, who I'm sure you don't recognize. Imon is dying. He has the cold consumption, the tumors in his stomach and his back.